Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, October 16th, 2019. SPLM North says they won't talk peace until an investigation is carried out into an alleged Nuba Mountains attack.
And we're asking the government also to make a thorough investigation to the chief who has been assassinated because he rejected the passing of nomads.
And on World Food Day, some South Sudanese say they can't afford to eat more than once a day.
We don't get our salaries in time, and the money I earn is little. So I cannot afford, like, buying food.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The SPLM North faction, based in Sudan's Nuba Mountains region, has suspended peace talks in Juba with Khartoum officials after military forces allegedly attacked several areas in the region and killed a sheikh on Tuesday. The group's leader says the sustained military campaign shows that the Sudanese government's failure to respect the cessation of hostilities agreement that the parties signed last month. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Amar Amoa, SPLM North Secretary General and a spokesperson for the group, told reporters in Juba today that his group will not take a part in any peace talks until there is a full investigation into the reported attack. He says for the last 10 days, Sudanese government forces have bombarded several areas of the Nuba Mountains. Amoa says even after the attacks, the SPLM North is committed to respecting the cessation of hostilities agreement, but that his group will no longer negotiate with the Sudanese government unless Khartoum meets the group's demands, including a statement from Khartoum about the bombing campaign. Amoa says the SPLM North also demands that the Sudanese government fully commit to the signed cessation of hostilities agreement with the rebels.
Our coming back to negotiating table is bound by government decisions to clear all these things. The government should withdraw its forces and stop from gaining new ground by occupying new areas. We will not allow that. And also, we need the government to release immediately the traders whom they have arrested with their all properties and hand them over to SPLM authorities.
Amoa says the fresh attack included 25 armed land cruisers that attacked civilians in Korwaral, an area of the Nuba Mountains controlled by the rebels. He says a chief named Sheikh Mohammed Afdal Fadil and one soldier were killed in the area while at least 10 people are missing.
And we are asking the government also to make a thorough investigation to the chief who has been assassinated because he rejected the passing of nomads in that new road which passes through farmlands.
The Sudanese government downplayed the accusations, blaming the attack on cattle herders. Speaking to reporters in Juba today, Mohammed Hassan Altais, a spokesman representing the transitional Sudanese government delegation at the peace, said the government has full knowledge of what he refers to as the incident and says the government will address it.
The incident happened at the context of local inhabitants who happened to be herders attacking local merchants. Some fell victim and got captured, and local goods were confiscated. The government regrets and condemns in the strongest terms these unfortunate events that keep happening in the area and in other parts of the country. We also regret that this event took place at a time when people are entering peace negotiations and the country and the whole region is united for the cause of peace in Sudan.
The Hassan says the government will investigate the incident and hold those responsible accountable. Speaking in Arabic, Tutkeu Galwak, President Salva Kiir's security advisor, who is also the chief mediator in the talks, called on the Sudanese authorities to quickly investigate the incident.
We have received a report from the SPLM North led by Al-Hilo because there is an incident that happened in the Nuba Mountains. It is an unfortunate incident. It's an environment of peace. We don't want any situation from both the parties that will interrupt the peace process.
According to mediators, the talks were slated to start between the Sudan government and an umbrella of rebel groups headed by Al-Hilo, comprised of three rebel groups, and later another umbrella of 12 rebel groups who call themselves Sudan Revolutionary Front or SRF. Before the announcement of the refusal of Al-Hilo's group to negotiate with the Sudanese government, mediators and other observers, including the African Union, had already convened at Juba's Pyramid Hotel, the venue where the talks were supposed to take place. Jeremiah Kingsley is AU ambassador to South Sudan, who offered assurances of support at the talks in Juba.
We are grateful that the parties have agreed to come here to begin talking. It's not going to be easy. We can only call upon them to find each other. It's in the interest of the Sudanese people who have suffered a great deal. They should put the interests of the people first.
On Monday, Al-Hilo said the African Union held 22 rounds of peace talks between the Sudanese government and the rebels, but the two sides had failed to address the root causes of the problem. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
On this World Food Day, some South Sudanese say they are struggling to put food on the table. One government worker says her family eats only one meal a day because food is too expensive and her salary is too small and often delayed. The head of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in South Sudan says his agency is distributing seeds and farming tools to help support families so they can produce their own food. Winnie Serino has more for VOA from Juba.
Benna Franca, a mother of three who cleans a government ministry building, says she was paid in September, but she is uncertain which month the payment was for since her paychecks are often delayed. Franca says she cannot afford to feed her children two times a day or pay for other basic necessities for her family.
We don't get our salaries in time, and the money I earn is little, so I cannot afford buying food, okay, making food twice or thrice in a day. How I help my children, if they're going to school, I wake up in the morning, make for them porridge.
29-year-old Beatrice Small, who works for a security company in Juba, says she also finds it nearly impossible to give her family two meals a day because the price of food has skyrocketed while salaries remain stagnant. Speaking in Arabic, Small says hunger is affecting her family's health.
The things in the market now are all expensive. There's nothing there that is cheap. Things are not easy as those days. If it was like those days, it would be good. Now you see many people suffer the way I suffer because there's no money to buy something to eat. You work, but the money is little. That is why someone can be sickly because there's no good food that you eat.
Meshak Malo, country representative of United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in South Sudan, says more than 6 million South Sudanese are food insecure. He says farmers in parts of South Sudan like Maban have tried to produce their own food, but floods in those areas have ruined the crops. Malo says the amount of food production depends on the planting season. He says South Sudan would be able to stop relying on food aid if its leaders would restore peace across the country.
protracted instability affects a lot production calendar. Agriculture is also a very sensitive activity. Planting has to be done at very specific times.
Malo says he realizes some IDPs in UN protection of civilian sites are unable to produce their own food because they have no access to farmable land or they lack proper certification of land titles to enable them to invest in agricultural production. But Malo says the FAO is working with the government to resolve issues of land tenure management and administration. He says South Sudanese farmers are expected to produce slightly more than over 700,000 metric tons of food this year, leaving a gap of 600,000 metric tons. He says that's why the FAO continues to give a variety of seeds to South Sudanese so they can plant crops.
We are planning for next year to distribute about 7,000 metric tons of seeds to the country. Secondly, we have got big programs that have got to do with farming tools. Thirdly, we'll be working a lot on ensuring that the food that is available in our distribution, we are putting a lot of vegetable seeds that we are importing all the way, some from Netherlands, some from Italy, to enhance the nutritional status.
Last week, the UN World Food Programme reported that despite a slight improvement in overall food security in South Sudan this year, the number of people in need is projected to go up to 5.5 million people beginning in January, because that's the time of the year when the households face additional hardship as food reserves from their subsistence farming are often nearly depleted. World Food Day is celebrated every October 16th in the effort to tackle global hunger. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sirino in Juba.
On this day, the UN has set aside to promote action to end malnutrition, which claims tens of millions of lives worldwide each year. We learn what one prominent NGO is doing to lead the fight. Reporter Adam Phillips spoke with Charles Owubu, a CEO of Action Against Hunger, which helps communities detect child malnutrition and treat it holistically with a nutrient-rich candy bar. Owubu, who often knew hunger as a child growing up in rural Ghana, sums up the current state of hunger in the world.
It's bad. Hunger is when you're not sure where your next meal is coming from. And if it persists for a long time, it is going to affect how you grow.
You get sick.
It gets sick, especially extreme cases. You die.
I understand you've had your own experience with this.
Yes, growing up in Ghana on the farm, I experienced hunger. And most of the time, it was between the time of planting and the time of harvesting. My parents were subsistence farmers, and there were many times that I personally did not know where my next meal was going to come from.
How did that feel? I guess it would be an emotional and a physical component.
It's no good. You go to your parents, you're crying, but they say there's no food. And they themselves are struggling, and that's where it becomes so painful.
Is it physically painful?
It is physically painful because after some point in time, you may drink water, but it's not enough. The urge is there. You cannot find the food to eat, and you become weak.
So what does your organization do?
Action Against Hunger, we've been around for more than 40 years, and our sole purpose is to make sure that children do not go through these hungry moments. And so what we do is to be able to work with the community to make sure that we help them to be able to predict if their children are going to go through that period.
But don't they already know? I mean, you would think that a family member would be acutely aware of whether the kid has enough food or not.
You're right. Normally, they should be able to know. But if you are in an environment where that is the norm, you get used to it. And that's where we come in, because the research is clear that children must be able to grow within a certain range at a certain time. So we come in, and then just by using a simple band, we are able to be able to tell the mother that there's a problem here and he or she needs help.
Please describe the band for us.
It's plastic. Three colors, green, yellow, and red. You wrap around your upper arm. It tells you whether your child is healthy based on those colors. So if it's green, your child is healthy. If it's yellow or red, your child is malnourished. Call it a nutrition thermometer.
So a mother comes to you or a chief or a health worker and says, okay, this is in the red zone. This kid is clearly malnourished. What happens next?
What we do quickly is, because the issue is a medical issue, there is food that has already been prepared called the plumpy nut. It's made up of a lot of nutrients, sugar, peanuts, biscuits, all the essential nutrients the child needs. And the kids love it, and so they would want to eat it. And within 45 days, they're already treated.
You're smiling when you say that.
I'm smiling because that small piece of food can save lives. This issue is predictable, it's preventable, and it is treatable.
Not to play devil's advocate here, but it's one thing to look around, there's no food, but I can imagine a situation where they can find out that they're malnourished, but there's no plumping at it. So it seems to me that your system requires a whole group of services, not just the knowledge of it, but the resources and, you know, the infrastructure to get the plumping nut to them. And so this wouldn't be for completely isolated children. It's for children where the resources already exist, but people are in the dark about the objective facts.
You're right. And so what we do usually is to make sure that we have the community health worker train them about all these processes. Then we show them where we can have access to this plumping nut, work with government, because we want national governments to be the ones to be aware and to be able to help the children. So then there's a whole supply chain piece that we do to provide the plumping nut through these community health workers to be able to help the children.
Have you already seen any concrete results from this band and the plumping nut?
Yes. Our study is very clear. When children are diagnosed with this issue, as many as 90% of them through this treatment survive. That is very high, 90%. And then after that, you stay in their community to be able to help them so that they don't go through it again.
That was Charles Owuba, CEO of Action Against Hunger, a global advocacy program that fights malnutrition in Africa, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Activists opposing a change in U.S. policy affecting refugees are arrested here in Washington. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what have your past relationships, personal or professional, taught you?
The one thing that I've learned is we can do a lot of things when we find the right person.
My past relationship has taught me to respect other people's, like my attitude towards them, learn to respect everyone.
These relationships have taught me a lot because I interact with people from different cultural backgrounds. So it has helped me to learn other people's cultural beliefs and ideas.
You can learn from like a hard worker, you can be a hard worker, and then you can learn how to handle your bad situation. You can learn how to control them. Even you can learn how to trust.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Representatives from Amnesty International USA, the Church World Service, or CSW, and the Council on American-Islamic Relations were among 18 people arrested by D.C. Capitol Police yesterday while protesting the U.S. change in its refugee resettlement policy. Co-sponsored by over a dozen groups, organizers staged a civil disobedience at the U.S. Capitol in an effort to bring attention to the plan to cut the refugee cap to just 18,000 next year, which is traditionally 95,000. Jen Smyers, Director of Policy and Advocacy for CSW, says the new cap is more than an 80% cut.
That's why we had 95 people holding pictures of refugees in symbolizing the 95,000 traditional number, and then 18 people who had life jackets on and were symbolizing the 18,000 number that the Trump administration has cut the numbers to.
Now, Jen, a supporter of the Trump administration might say that the United States is very generous when it comes to refugee resettlement. What's your response, if someone said that to you?
Well, I think that we have been generous in the past, but that's not a reason to cut refugee resettlement numbers. You know, refugee resettlement is not not just about being generous. Refugees come to the United States and they improve the U.S. economy. They start working right away. They pay taxes. They buy homes. They become U.S. citizens. They contribute to the local economies. So it's not just a humanitarian program, but also refugee resettlement is really part of what it means to be a leader on the global stage. And that's one of the reasons why refugee resettlement is important. But I don't think that we can look at an 18,000 refugee resettlement number as generous, because it's not. It actually puts us at the bottom of the list in terms of refugee resettlement countries, and it ignores the fact that many countries around the world are hosting hundreds of thousands, in some cases, millions of refugees.
But the United States is a major funder of refugee programs. What would you say to someone who says that on the funding side, the United States is doing a lot?
Well, funding is important, but we have to be looking at our strategies and our commitments in multiple ways. It's not all about funding. Certainly, infrastructure support and funding is part of the solution, but refugee resettlement also plays a really key role in leveraging other countries to keep their doors open, in really urging other countries to allow refugees to work, to allow refugee children to go to school. You know, we are in those conversations in part because of the funding, but also in part because we have traditionally been a leader in refugee resettlement. And just because we're doing one thing doesn't mean we can stop doing another. It really does. It's interconnected. It impacts each other. So, you know, there's no reason for the United States to reduce refugee resettlement. We have many communities around the country, faith groups and volunteers who want to continue to welcome refugees. Refugees have benefited the U.S. economy. There's no reason to cut refugee resettlement, and it's not a justification to say, well, we're giving money so we can cut refugee resettlement. The two are interconnected and part of the overall strategy for U.S. humanitarian work.
That was Jen Smyers, the Director of Policy and Advocacy at Church World Services, speaking to Ayan Dang Bior here in Washington. A South Sudanese community member in Canada says most South Sudanese with mental health cases there suffer in silence. James Swaka, who resides in Canada, has facilities that can offer treatment for individuals undergoing serious mental health problems. He says families taking care of their loved ones who have mental health issues should seek help.
People who have mental issues, they're going through stress and hardships and even getting to a position where they're not able to function. So these people, when they approach us, somebody like me, I do have resources that I can refer to and say, you know, you can go to this direction and to these people, and they will be able to help you in terms of counseling, in terms of psychological assessments, in terms of all these things that could be a step forward in helping you come out of that kind of situation that you're in. Whether it adults or even kids, because this problem is not only the adults, even kids are suffering, but because the parents do not acknowledge that this is a problem and they live with it, and it's now affecting the whole family. But the openness is not there, first of all. There's this shame where we as South Sudanese think that if I open up to, say, me or somebody else, then how are they going to look at me? But for us who have been in this field, we know the confidentiality boundaries around these things, is that if you really approach me, I can help you without even saying anything. Because it's at the end of the day, it's the larger community they were looking at. A healthy community is a thriving community. So these are the things that we look at. However, we still struggle with it. With the little bits of our word mouth going out to people and saying, you know, we have these resources, we are available to help. But I mean, again, people tend to look at, you know, who is he, who is if, and how does he relate to people?
Yeah. And does that, you know, discourage you from doing what you're doing?
I mean, for me, it doesn't discourage me, because if I can help one person, it's still better than not helping anybody. And I always encourage people is that even if I can help one or two people, it doesn't mean that I've lost out. I've done something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've given back to the capacity that I can. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, if I can help one person, that person helps another person, you multiply it. Yeah. And that's what is supposed to be the meaning of community thriving.
And what is your assessment of the impact of the conflict at home on people here?
Actually,
when you interact with them,
it's a very big factor actually. And the community here is so divided because of the issues that are back home. So it's been transferred from the village to the cities in southern Sudan, to the country of Canada, to the small pockets of families within Canada itself. So there's a big impact of what is happening in South Sudan in here. And some of them are just because they hear stories from individuals or they hear it over the radio and then they don't analyze it properly and it just goes around and it divides the community up in many different negative ways.
That was James Swaka, a South Sudanese-Canadian who is advising new South Sudanese families who have resettled in Canada. He was speaking with my colleague John Tanza in Kitchener, Waterloo. In part four of our interview, Swaka talks about how the conflict in South Sudan has affected his South Sudanese community in Canada.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
That is our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with a song, No Beer in Heaven by Atongo Zimba.
Living in the world, my brother, then. Living in the world, my sister. But you live in this world, you living in the world, my mama. Some are really gonna hate you, some are really gonna love you, and some are really gonna hate you. Yeah, we don't wanna kaga, we don't wanna know about the combat, but for the yoli bale, yeah, we don't wanna go on, yeah, we don't wanna kaga, yeah, we don't wanna kaga, living in the world, my sister. Some are really gonna love you, and some are really gonna hate you. Yeah, we don't wanna kaga,
there is no beer. That is why we be drinking all the beer.
For when will the golden ride
to heaven? All our friends will be drinking all the beer. Hey, 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 hey.
We don't wanna know about the kamanga. Yeah, we don't wanna know about the kamanga. Yeah, we don't wanna kaga, hey, hey, hey. But tell me my yele pada numba. My bote yele pada. Yeah, we don't wanna know. Yeah, we don't wanna kaga la la kanga. Yeah, we don't wanna kaga, hey, hey, hey.
We've been listening to Atongo Zimba with his special song, No Beer in Heaven. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles this evening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Yeah, we don't wanna kanga, eh.